It's an art that needs a scroll.
Hey, good morning. It is KBOO, KBOO Portland. A minute before 9 o'clock, and in 1 hour, join us for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary on the Boo. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, former CIA officer Ray McGovern discusses Hillary Clinton's lies about security breaches and her private email server. Also, our weekly election protection bulletin with Greg Pallast. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Bethany Grabo speaks with Jesse Andrews, author of the new novel The Haters. And then at 11:30 on The Film Show, Jen Chavez speaks with local experimental filmmaker Vanessa Rennick. Also on the show, Portland Horror Film Festival organizer Gwen Callahan, Daylight's End producer Sherry Dieterling, and director Will Kaufman, and Josh Leek. That's all coming up this morning after 1 hour of Press Watch. It's news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell right after this.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And this KBOO program is also made possible in part by Seattle Theater Group, presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies. Two evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September are on sale now, and more information is available at portland5.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counterpropaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek of video veil, behind the video veil, at an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. When times are this crazy, this show writes itself. The latest thing about North Korea is a series of articles in the press talking in detail about a war against North Korea. Here's a quote from one from MarketWatch.com, a business site, quoting, the effectiveness of the B-2 bomber first wave would enable the 24 F-22 fighters and the wave of 600 or so cruise missiles sharing the skies to focus on destroying North Korea's delivery vehicles. A single good hit from a JDAM or cruise missile is enough to knock out the nascent sea-based leg of North Korea's defensive triad, hammering the Wiju and Changjin up air bases where North Korean H-5 bombers are based would further reduce Pyongyang's most likely air delivery force for a nuclear weapon. The most difficult target to eliminate when it comes to delivery vehicles is the missile forces. North Korea has a fleet of approximately 200 transporter erector launchers of varying size and type spread out across the country, so the intelligence picture would have to be very... This goes on. I'm trying to give you an idea of the stuff that's in the press. The stuff that's in the press worries me because we're talking about a war that would kill a million people within a couple of hours. And why is that okay? Why is it possible to put out articles in the press? And the sort of article that I was reading comes in the context of decades of American, frankly, CIA-led propaganda. When a war is cooking up, the sort of thing that gets Americans all excited about just what a big bang they can make. Why is this okay? Why is it okay to kill a million people? Is it because they're not white people? I mean, that would fall in American history as well, wouldn't it? Is it just okay to kill Koreans? a war with North Korea should not be contemplated. It's really too bad and rather frightening that they have some nuclear weapons. That's not an excuse for war. Here's another one from ABC. U.S. President Barack Obama has taken aim at North Korea, describing it as, quote, a big worry, end quote, after a meeting with G7 counterparts as tensions escalate following Pyongyang's series of nuclear tests. There's a lot of these articles in the press. So I'm telling you this to warn you, and I hope that somebody somewhere will make some political hay about this, because I don't know anyone who wants a war with Korea. Do you? Somebody does, but it ain't the American people. And, of course, that's just the start of the craziness in the news. And since it's still in the news, I will comment on the anti-transgender movement. The latest is that Idaho has joined those stellar social paradigms like Alabama and Texas in filing a lawsuit against the federal government to prevent transgender people from just thinking that they can go about like normal people and use a public restroom when they need to. I could go into the details, but I won't. What I want to say is that it isn't about danger of predators or religious freedom or women's and girls' safety, or any of those dog whistle excuses, which, by the way, are recycled from pro-Jim Crow arguments half a century ago. No, it's about hate. Those of you who maintain that you have some logical reason to bar people like me from restrooms are just full of hate. You're making it up, and I urge you to confront it and deal with it. You hate people that you can't control. That's a characteristic of conservatives everywhere. The violence in restrooms, to the extent that it exists at all, is directed against transgender persons now, isn't it? It's not the other way around. It's a backlash of hatred, the fodder of demagogues everywhere. All this talk, maybe that's what they drink, demagog. All this talk is also an action. It's a call to arms against transgender persons. It's a hope that violence will break out and that the domination of conformist patriarchy can again reign on the basis of terror. It's just hate. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, amen. Also in the news, U.S. nuclear plants are more dangerous than has been let on. No big surprise for those who follow this sort of things. Science Magazine has come out with an article. I guess that's the news, that Science Magazine is actually talking about this. Warning that the spent fuel accumulating at U.S. nuclear plants is vulnerable. After fuel is removed from a reactor core, the radioactive fission products continue to decay, generating heat. All nuclear power plants store the fuel on site at the bottom of deep pools for at least 4 years while it slowly cools. To keep it safe, the Academy's report, this article refers to an Academy, recommends that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and nuclear plant operators beef up systems for monitoring the pools and topping up water levels in case a facility is damaged. The panel says plants should also be ready to tighten security after a disaster. At most U.S. nuclear plants, spent fuel is densely packed in pools, heightening the fire risk. NRC has estimated that a major fire at a spent fuel at, say, the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania would displace an estimated 3.46 million people from 31,000 square kilometers of contaminated land, an area larger than New Jersey. But the researchers referenced in this article think that the NRC has grossly underestimated the scale and societal cost of such a fire. The NRC used a program for modeling the dispersal and deposition of radioactivity from a Peach Bottom fire, but the new model from researchers Schuttner and von Hippel used a program able to craft a more sophisticated scenario based on historical weather data for the whole region. In other words, they just tracked where the wind was likely to blow. And in their simulations, the Princeton duo focused on cesium-137, a radioisotope with a 30-year half-life that has made large tracts around Chernobyl and Fukushima uninhabitable. They assumed a release of 1,600 petabecquerels, which is the average amount of cesium-137 that the NRC estimates would be released from a fire at a densely packed pool. It's also approximately 100 times the amount spewed at Fukushima. Fukushima. They simulated such a release on the first day of each month in 2015. The contamination from such a fire on U.S. soil would be an unprecedented peacetime catastrophe, they say. And they estimate that a relocation order would be 101,000 square kilometers. That's more than three times the NRC's estimate, if it wasn't scary enough, and the relocation of 18 million people from one nuclear power plant fuel fire is about five times the NRC's estimate. You can find that article at sciencemag.org. sciencemag.org. It's featured there, so you won't have any difficulty finding it. Time is 9:09, almost 10 minutes after 9. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I invite your comments and questions on today's topics. I have something to bring up about maldistribution of wealth. Oh, and by the way, wasn't that some fantastic radio from 8 to 9 o'clock? Joanne has done it again with Kshama Sawant right here on the KBOO airwaves. You can get that if you missed some of it. You can get it on KBOO.fm. And it should be available within a few minutes. But I want to talk about maldistribution of wealth. It should matter to you. Probably it does matter to you. Statistically, it matters. But let me begin with this article. This will seem like a tangent, but I think you'll understand in a moment. It's from Alex Davies, and it was in Wired magazine a few months ago, titled "China's Self-Driving Bus Shows Autonomous Tech's Real Potential." And he wrote, "In September, Chinese bus manufacturer Yutong announced its self-driving bus had successfully driven on public roads. For all the excitement surrounding autonomous vehicles," he wrote, "most of the attention is focused on what the technology will mean for consumers who might finally be freed from the tyranny of the commute. No less revolutionary is what the technology might mean for mass transit and trucking." And he writes, "granted, robo-trucks and self-driving buses aren't nearly so sexy as, say, Audi's gorgeous autonomous A7 or as friendly as Google's cute self-driving gumdrop of a car, but the technology is here now and proving itself in real-world testing. Just last week, a Mercedes-Benz Actros big rig equipped with Daimler's Highway Pilot system made the 15-mile run from Dinkendorf to Stuttgart, Germany, on Highway A8, staying within its lane and maintaining a safe following distance. That test followed an announcement by Chinese manufacturer Yutong that its autonomous bus handled 26 traffic signals, several lane changes, and at least one passing maneuver during a 20-mile drive between Zhengzhou and Kaifeng. Yutong hasn't revealed much of its technology, but says the bus uses laser, radar, and camera systems on each side of the vehicle. Daimler's autopilot system has a stereoscopic camera to read lane lines and short and long range radar to scan the road for obstacles up to 800 feet ahead. Reading from an article in Wired.com a few months ago, he writes, "As impressive as these tests are, they pale compared to what more advanced prototypes can do. Google's cars have racked up more than 1 million miles on public roads using technology so sophisticated it can, for example, recognize a cyclist's hand signals." There's much more to that article. But the point is, the reason I'm reading this, is that we are now faced with replacement of a vast labor force, truck drivers and bus drivers. And I don't think this will be easily stopped. I don't know exactly how soon this is coming, but I think I can easily say within the next decade. And there are going to be arguments made for this, and there are going to be some pretty good arguments. Returning to the Wired article, 280 buses were involved in fatal accidents that killed 310 people in 2013. About 4,000 people die each year in crashes involving trucks, most of them in passenger cars. According to a 2009 study, 71% of large truck crashes occurred while the truck driver was distracted. It's autonomous systems that support or supplant human drivers will not text, fumble for cigarettes, or talk on the phone. They will not get stressed or tired or drunk. Beyond the lives lost, large truck and bus crashes cost $87 billion in damages in 2013. Active safety features that do things like keep a vehicle within its lane and brake automatically to avoid crashes already improve safety. Full automation will almost certainly build on that. And so just to summarize, Oh, and by the way, when you hear that 280 buses were involved in fatal accidents, remember that there's 300 million people in the United States. There's something like 30,000-40,000 killed in automobile accidents, and you're much, much safer on a bus. So keep the statistical proportions in mind. Don't worry about that. But the point is, buses, for example, and certainly trucks, can be automated, and they will be automated. They are being automated. These jobs will be lost. It is so much cheaper. It will be so much cheaper to have an automated bus. The reason being, you don't have to pay a driver's salary, pension, health insurance, anything. No driver. Not only that, these things don't get tired. Charge them up, run them 24 hours a day. You ain't paying salaries. And this is definitely going to happen. So what happens, though? What happens to the drivers? What happens to the society? The article's author has described just one aspect of automation that is coming to take away more jobs from humans. Uber, don't you think, will swiftly choose robots over pesky people, and an Uber car will be a robot car in just a few years. That's my prediction. All the wealth that flows into the community from truck drivers and bus drivers' salaries will dry up. Foreclosures will follow. Unless we make a critical new perception about labor and automation. As human beings, we share in an ever-developing technological revolution, but somehow, though we are all descended from the inventors and scientists who created it over the past few centuries, only the very rich are benefiting from the economic cornucopia. Automated mass manufacturing means we can buy lasers at the dollar store, but wages are so low and jobs are so scarce that millions are homeless in the supposedly wealthy society. And indeed, there is wealth. Jets that soar across the world, automobiles in such numbers that they crowd the roads, cities that hold millions and sparkle in the night, but that wealth is so grotesquely pinched that half the population is in constant danger of financial disaster. That's probably you. And the rich hide trillions offshore. Obviously, maldistribution of wealth is happening, and maldistribution of wealth must come to an end, not only for the millions who suffer in poverty and homelessness, but so that people can have the agency, time, and education opportunities to regain control of the society for the society. I say again, the wealth is here and in great quantity, and what is to be done? So I would say the answer is not merely jobs, although this will never be a peaceful society until living wage jobs are available to all. The answer may be in part to directly redistribute the wealth. We can't go back in time and unautomate factories and unautomate cars and buses so that people can have jobs. Those are lousy jobs anyway, but the wealth of automation is here and increasing. Let's just take it. It's our birthright. And not the birthright of the Walton family or the Koch brothers, nor should it ever have belonged to the Pentagon imperialist machine. And speaking of war making, we should realize that U.S. capitalist society declared a war on the working and professional classes some time ago. And it is winning, because we haven't learned to fight back. If an invader forced us into paying half and more of our incomes on rent and forced a million of us onto the streets, we would fight like mad. But we let the parasite billionaire class do it to us. Why? I say again, technological wealth is our patrimony. From Aristotle to James Watt to Edison to Carver to Steve Jobs, inventions have changed our world, and yet we have given up the resulting wealth to the wealthy and stripped the worker of all dignity. And isn't it a lack of dignity to have some job that you have to go to get close to paying enough? A job that you have to go to slip further into debt. A job where you can be so easily replaced by a vast pool of the desperate. Now we face a global disaster from outmoded petroleum, coal, and nuclear technologies, and yet we must yield the vast share of wealth and power to the parasite class. This must end. Our system is terminally violent. We cannot afford conformity. We can't go along to get along. This is the end of it. Fortunately, we have forward-looking Finland to lead the way, and I want to read a little bit from an article in Demos Helsinki, Finland, about basic income, and this is about redistributing the wealth. They write, from Finland to the Netherlands, Switzerland to Canada, governments and cities have embraced the basic income idea as one worth testing. Although talk of basic income has been around for some time, it seems that now there is real push, an unwavering drive and motivation to see how the idea could work in practice. And speaking for myself, we're talking about giving people like $1,000 a month. Beyond the hype, however, they write lie some crucial questions, that need to be addressed. With support from all sides of the political spectrum and interest from cities and states all over the world, it is evident that the discussion on basic income is painstakingly broad in scope and variety. What do we even mean when we talk about basic income? Are we talking about the same thing, as the following years will undoubtedly be vital stepping stones in the testing and development of one of the most important social innovations of the 21st century? The need to focus on the nuances is growing. They write, while it is unbelievably exhilarating that so many have begun to see basic income as something worth trying, now is not the time to stop. Rather, it's time to start the conversation and go from abstract to concrete. What kind of basic income are you advocating for, and why should it be implemented? Now, departing from that text, isn't it surprising to hear that? For the Finnish writer, this is an exciting idea, much in circulation. Everybody's talking about basic income. For U.S. citizens, this is unheard of. In part because any talk of, well, I'll bet some of you are like, did I hear that right? Yes. For U.S. citizens, this is unheard of. In part because any talk of wealth redistribution is first met with a carefully, multi-generationally inculcated sullen resentment. That's true, regardless of whether the idea does or could have merit, or whether the society would be a better one. It's automatic, a knee-jerk American response of fearing that someone somewhere will get something you aren't getting, even if we're talking about giving the same amount to everyone. But that's why I call this the news you're not supposed to know. You are not supposed to think about this. So I invite your calls and comments, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. At the basis of it, there are various forms. Finland is going to be doing this in 2017. I mean, they're going to be doing it. And, you know, this would work out if you're wealthy, the $1,000 would just get eaten up by taxes. It would just be a gesture. But of course, if you're not wealthy, that $1,000 would really help you. Or maybe it's a little more, or maybe it's a little less, but they're going to experiment with it. And I think that's pretty exciting. Joan is on the air. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hello, Joan.
Hello. I called when I heard you talking about robot cars.
Yes.
Which has got to be the stupidest idea to ever come down the turnpike.
How do you figure?
I would like to invite everyone out there who's ever owned or used a computer to imagine that your computer never fails, never crashes, or never glitches out. And have you ever experienced such a computer? And a computer is only as good as its program, and someone programs the computer. And so being free of human error there is absolutely not possible. And one thing that the robot car will not have is the motive to not die. So when I get in my car, I'm going to pay attention and be careful because I really don't want to get into a car crash where the car itself may or may not have this motive. So the idea of somehow everyone's going to be safer, if somehow cars are controlled by what, which of course it's not possible to hack into such a system and cause chaos, of course not. Or would you rather actually take responsibility for controlling your own vehicle as you drive around the street?
I think you raised some great points. And
if I was in a bus, I would want to know that if a little kid ran in front of the bus, that the bus driver would see this, and would the bus actually see it? I even read, somebody said something, I think it was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, about Google was actually, it's like so comical, thinking of making their bumpers sticky. So if the car does,
so people would not be thrown when it's struck.
They won't get thrown, so you'll be
okay. Well, now you've raised a lot of good points, and so before you go further, and before I forget them, I want to counter some of them.
It's absolutely insane as to why people would trust the technology that people make. Who knows who these people are, and that other people can hack into, rather than trusting their own intelligence and desire to stay alive and cooperate with others, because really that's the best thing we've got going.
Well, let me answer that. The reason it's going to happen is because it's economically viable. Also, regarding computers crashing, what a pain that is. I have a computer that hasn't crashed. I've had it for 2 years. It has never crashed.
Well, good for you. That's really wonderful, and I'm sure it will last forever and never decide to get to punk out because you need
The point that I want to make here is that Regardless of the fact that the systems will and do fail, they are already measurably safer than people. And also, they are... I'm sorry?
By whose measurement? Who's measuring all this?
Well, certainly DARPA was measuring it, but it's gone much further than that. Google has been keeping statistics on their cars. Their crash records are a matter of public record. They are, in fact, safer than humans at this point.
There's also talk of people, you know, if my car is driving itself, I can sit there eating my lunch and playing the harmonica and not paying the slightest bit of attention. Why should I? And then something suddenly happens and I realize I need to do something, but too bad. They can say whatever they like. I think it's a kind of stupid idea, and I'm sure people may have other opinions on this. That happens to be mine.
Well, sure, and that's great. And I would say stupid idea or not, it's definitely coming because it will save so much money. It'll save so much money for the elites. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because this and other forms of automation are kicking us out of jobs at a pretty rapid rate. I mean, I think there was a CEO for a major, a former CEO actually, for a major fast food chain who was saying that a $35,000 robot would be a better investment than spending for our workers. Well, he's not paying attention because the sort of facility he's talking about would be closer to $1 million even today. But it is coming. And so I want to talk about universal basic income for all American adults paid each month at a sufficient level to eliminate poverty in the United States. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that people are afraid of losing their jobs, not because they love being slaves to their jobs, but because we all need the income in order to survive in the system that we've got. So if nobody needs, quote, jobs, unquote, I think that would be very nice. But we do need to have, as long as we've got money, we need to have enough of it to live, and that's why we're all hooked into this thing, which nobody really likes. So a way out of it is a really good idea. You know, how that would work, I don't know. I'm certainly not afraid of some lazy person that doesn't want to work, because I don't see why. It's not really about jobs. It's about survival, and I think that's what we need to focus on.
Right on. Thanks very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. I was slipping in a quote from Jim Pugh, the CEO of Share Progress, who was writing in the Finnish article. He said he thinks it would be necessary to first introduce a smaller universal income, still paying out money every month, but not as much as a full basic income. Once Americans have had a chance to experience this program and appreciate its benefits, and once sufficient funding sources can be identified, we can work to transition to a full basic income in the U.S. And he writes, for me, the main reason to push for basic income is to counter the rising inequality that's being driven by technological unemployment and underemployment. The nature of work is changing, and we need a new social safety net that's suited to these changes. Basic income will allow us to gracefully transition to a society where full employment is no longer the expectation. And when I see this, I ask myself, what effect will this have on the maldistribution of wealth according to race? There have been wealth distribution programs before, for example, the GI Bill, which helped in many ways in terms of getting a house and education, and black people are cut out of it. So just having a program like this doesn't mean that race would be addressed. As a matter of fact, I would say given the racial and gender content of the U.S. Senate, it likely wouldn't be. Of course, given the content of the Senate right now, it wouldn't even be addressed, considered, or spoken aloud of, but that's another matter. But Brian is on the air. The number to call, 503-231-8187. It's 928, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Teresa. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Italy has, to me, the most common sense and practical solution, in which if someone gets laid off or gets fired or unemployed, the government gives them a choice of, I don't remember if it's 6 months or a year of monthly benefits to start their own business, plus they give them logistical support and training. And to me, you talk about, you know, that gives somebody a feeling of being worthwhile and self-respect and self-sufficient. I can't see, I mean, the elites here would fight that tooth and nail because that takes them out of the slavery.
Oh, yeah, and we'd have to take it from them.
Business. But and I really would like to see something like that here. You know, the GI, I know a couple of guys that have gone to college in the GI Bill, and they're doing pretty well as structural engineers. But, yeah, it would be great to see. I mean, it would increase... small businesses are the backbone of any kind of reasonably democratic society, and this would really help to bring that about. So that's my 10 cents worth.
Well, thanks, Brian.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Number call 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. I've been talking about basic income, been talking about the war on trans, been talking about the war on workers, and worried again about war on North Korea. And Ken is on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I love your program. And I have to agree with you. I think Joanne Hardesty's program is always great. I appreciated yours. And today was just a dynamite program, as usual.
Anyway, it was fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, she was great. She is great. You guys get me up early on Thursday. So.
Well, Kshama Sawant gives me so much hope. I mean, imagine this. Here's just an idea. I don't know how viable it would be. But we need some form of actual democracy in the United States. What if cities began to elect socialists and anarcho-socialists and people who actually cared about society into the city councils? And the city councils started getting together across states and across cities to form a government that could actually address homelessness, that could address policy issues that we care about. You know, what if we started introducing democracy that way through city councils?
It was a hope for a dream.
Yeah.
What can I say? Anyway, I'd like to make a few comments, if I may.
Please.
Also, I always enjoy hearing Brian. It's just a pleasure. To hear what he has to say,
yep.
And the just preceding speaker, but about that Italy deal, I think what they say is that if you get 9 other people or 7 other people together, then the government will, and you have a business plan to start some kind of a business that will employ people, and then the government has a generous support for your program.
Oh, now that's got to be very different, because despite all the talk of supporting small businesses in the United States, it's not at all easy to start a small business
No.
in the United States. It requires a great deal of capital, and there are many licenses and difficulties, and a huge part of the difficulties that anyone would face is the large corporations that don't want to give up any ground
exactly.
anywhere. For example, I think it was 17 Walmarts that have been flooded into the Greater Portland metro area. They will follow their usual business model, which is they have the 17 stores now. They will break, and they are breaking, other grocery stores and other right. hardware stores, and they're going to have low prices, and of course, always low wages. And
yes.
they're going to take their welfare from food stamps to their workers that they don't pay enough. Mm. And they're going to break everyone else. And then, surprise, they'll say, oh, we've got too many stores, and we just need to go back down to 2-3 mega stores. And oh, look, the prices went up.
Yes. And all the tax breaks we got from the local chamber and so on and so forth are just swept under the rug, you know?
Yep.
Anyway, I have some questions also for you.
Please.
First of all, I know that you experienced a weather anomaly when you were in Texas. I mean, excuse me, in South America, in
yes,
Mexico.
In Mexico, yeah.
And I wonder if you ever followed that up with National Weather Service or something to get some kind of explanation for what happened and how it happened.
I didn't ask. I didn't ask anyone directly. I did search the web trying to figure out what had happened. Talking about Hurricane Patricia, and of course I want to say Mexico is in North America, but it's south of here. But Hurricane Patricia was measured rather carefully as the most powerful hurricane ever, and it started heading for where I was at, Puerto Vallarta and Bucerías. And when I say that, I just mean that I was there. I was following the tracking the forecast, and for, you know, for a few hours, a couple or a few hours, it was headed straight for us, and I really thought that we would be obliterated. And these winds were, if I remember correctly, they were close to 200 miles an hour.
Right.
I think, to make a long story short, the center core, there's a couple things that happened. The core winds did not hit particularly populated areas on the coast. They did wipe out some towns, and those deaths are to be mourned, but it didn't cause the sort of devastation that less powerful hurricanes have caused, say, in the Philippines recently, the sort of thing that was in my mind and that I thought was certainly coming for me and everyone there. The width of the wall of destruction when it hit the coast was not nearly as wide as a hurricane that powerful should be, regardless of whether it was, you know, tight or different in some way that we had previously examined. And my opinion is that because it had so much power in it, it took a different shape. And it went inland and hit Guadalajara at 3,000 feet altitude. I mean, it just trashed Guadalajara, which wasn't expecting to get hit from a hurricane because it was much further inland and it's up 3,000 feet. So that was just bizarre. And all I can say at this point is something very different happened. I do think it had to do with global warming. And I think that eventually hurricanes like this will change modeling and will change the effects. Yeah. And more than that, I don't know.
Well, it is curious and interesting. But my other question is, and here's something I'm just totally ignorant of, but speaking of, Fukushima?
The Japanese NHK says, yeah. Fukushima.
Fukushima. Okay, thank you. I've read that the people say, well, they don't know what's happened to the core. Well, I read someplace that the cores exactly have become particularized. I don't know what the right term is. They've disappeared into infinitely small particles that are now airborne. And I wondered what your take on that would be.
Well, they don't know where these cores are. Certainly a lot of it has been vaporized. There's an article by Chris Busby on that where was Chris Busby's article? It was in RT.com, okay. Russia Today. And he was talking about these cores, tons of them, they've just gone China syndrome, basically. They're sinking down, and the TEPCO, the Japanese corporation that is responsible for the plants, does not know where they are. And the disaster at Fukushima is ongoing. It's not a matter of it being in a cleanup stage. It's a matter of hanging on by their fingernails. And and so I wanted to bring up the fact that we have reactors all over the United States with these.
Same design.
Same design, and we've got spent fuel in pools, right. Like as if earthquakes don't happen, as if pools don't crack, as if uranium doesn't burn.
Well, these are usually built on fault lines, right? I mean,
well,
that's the first choice in site design planning, is find a fault line and then build a nuclear power plant on it.
Yeah, ironically, it almost seems that way.
Also, about the basic income, I think it, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was put forth once upon a time by, guess who, Richard Nixon, and also by George McGovern when he ran. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And
there's a different time. Nixon was the last president to expand the welfare state.
Yeah, well, also, I understand, have you just retired, is that so?
Yes, I have retired. I mean,
well, I want to congratulate you on that.
And well, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoy it immensely. And so anyway.
Yeah, I do enjoy it. I mean, because I've been talking about the desperation of the worker, and I've finally gotten to the point where I am entitled to a pittance, darn it. And that's much better than not being entitled to a pittance.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling
in. I'm so glad you have an hour. I wish you had it every week.
Well, thank you very much. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Been talking about basic income, been talking about nuclear reactors, threat of war with North Korea, the war on trans, the war on workers, and Mitch is on the air.
Oh, yeah, thanks for taking my call, and congratulations. I just heard that you'd retired, and I know you had spent many years with TriMet, and I can't think of anything that qualifies as public service more than that. So,
well, thank you.
You got a lot to be proud of there. Thanks. Wanted to follow up on your first caller this morning, Joan, and she made some good points about the automatic cars and
yes.
how we're all getting excited about the robots running the cars. And I think what often gets missed here is an argument that I always wind up having with libertarian friends who I respectfully tend to disagree with, because once you start putting the emphasis on freedom without responsibility, you get into the same sort of trouble that Ben Franklin got into by recognizing that his inventiveness stemmed from the fact that he was basically a very lazy chap, because he always wanted to keep inventing things that would cut down on him having to do anything. And I think Joan made some points in her call about that really sink down deep into the core of human nature, is that once we're freed from the responsibility of measuring our actions in relationship to others, that's the road to hell and the road to lack of accountability.
Say that again.
that if you turn over the responsibility of driving a motor vehicle to a pre-programmed, and she's right, anything that is programmed is going to be programmed by fallible human beings. So you may have a computer that hasn't broken down yet, but it's going to.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point.
And it's just the fact that America is great at selling freedom, but we never sell it with its contingency, which is responsibility.
Yes, that's part of the propaganda. And my point is that the billionaires are going to want to buy these things and replace motor vehicles to the greatest extent possible, because that's just going to be more cash under the current paradigm in their pocket. And I certainly want to change the current paradigm. I mean, an example of what you're talking about is the algorithms that have to be programmed into cars to choose. For example, let's say you're going down the road and you see a little girl on a bicycle on your left and a car careening towards you on your right, and the road is set up so that you cannot escape both collisions. Which person is going to get hit? Is it going to be three people in the car heading towards you, or is it going to be the little kid on the bicycle? So what algorithm is going to be programmed into the car? It's like asking a machine to make a moral decision. The only way you can get even close to that is to pre-program it. So how's that going to work out? Which I think is creepy. And I also think it's the idea of a self-driving car is just creepy. I do enjoy driving cars. and at the same time, I can see that it is coming, will come. It's going to be part of our lives.
Well, I don't feel that way, because when you cite the Google statistics, this takes me back to my theme of the problems we run into when freedom is untethered from responsibility, because the testing that would be allowed for any pioneering company developing the driverless car, the testing would not allow human beings to be put in danger, you see. And so you can't test to actual road conditions.
Well, it's already gone way beyond that. Actual road conditions are being tested now.
Putting people in danger, in harm's way.
Doubtless.
That seems an awful close to the Mengele theory of science. So if that's what they're doing, then there ought to be a public interest lawyer somewhere making hay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, I've been talking about basic income. And was using as a basis a Finnish article about the idea of basic income. And this is an idea of giving everyone, say, $1,000 a month, somewhere around that amount, in order to help eliminate poverty. If you're a human being, then you get the $1,000. And of course, the way it'd work out, if you're, you know, affluent, then that it just gets snapped up by your taxes. But if you're not affluent, well, then there's $1,000. And wouldn't that help? Alina Lepomäki, a member of Finnish Parliament, writes, "I support a personal welfare account that records the charges paid and benefits received during one's lifetime. It flexibly clears away welfare traps during different phases of life for low, middle, and high-income groups. It puts faith in the individual and the liberty and responsibility of humans to make choices concerning their own finances. The Life Account would update Social Security to meet labor markets of today and the future. Without a comprehensive reform, she writes, the public system of transfer payments cannot be financed. And I think when she says that, she means kind of have to tax the super rich and really tax them, eliminate super richness. In addition, she writes, the change would be philosophical, empowering people to make decisions that concern their own lives, taking care of everyone's basic security together and helping those who cannot make it on their own even better than today. And I'm interested in the ramifications of this. I mean, it'll be so interesting to see the Finnish experiment in 2017, because I want to know how it affects people's concept of their participation in society, how they view themselves to have this basic security. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Lynn is on the air.
Morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hey, congratulations on your retirement. TriMet drivers are the best. Too bad they don't have a better organization to work for.
Well, thank you.
So I wanted to bring something up that you might not know about, because I had no idea. It turns out that if you're a veteran and you turn 65 and you're making under this amount, you are eligible for a pension that will get your income up to $1,027 a month. So some of us do have access to a guaranteed annual income.
Oh, well, that's a good thing. And you're bringing it up because maybe people don't know about it?
Yeah, exactly. The other thing, as far as what Brian was talking about, this may have changed, but as of 2014, when I got laid off, the state of Oregon Unemployment Division actually has something like that, to where they will provide some support for starting your own little business.
Oh, well, that's good news, too.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a good day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much for calling. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. I'm inviting your calls at 503-231-8187. The topics that I've brought up so far this morning, including the news headlines, would be, I would say, another threat of war with North Korea. Of course, I've been saying that the whole time I've been on the air, just about. The way the U.S. Seems to deal with North Korea is to constantly threaten war. So I don't know how seriously to take it, except to say that it is unacceptable, it is a risk, and there should be public awareness and therefore public opposition to any imperial adventure in Korea, because as I've said, despite the bluster, the artillery pieces that North Korea has hidden in the mountains, the tunnels that they have dug, are an effective counter strategy, and if they are struck with cruise missiles, then they will surely start a war that will kill a million. Not acceptable in any way. And yeah, I can back up those figures. Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. And of course, I've been talking about basic income also. I've been talking about the war on trans people. Ted's on the air.
Hi, Teresa. It's a great show you have. I'd like to say how much I like the idea of a basic income. I think it should be, it's going to be politically hard, but I think Nordic countries have been thinking about this for quite a while, and some have even partially implemented it. And I think it should be greatly expanded. And I would like to say that I think the greatest lie that's been foisted on Western culture is the perceived need for jobs. We do not need jobs. We need food, water, shelter. We don't need jobs.
I see that at KBOO all the time. People come here and put all kinds of labor into volunteering at KBOO. The engineer, for example, does a terrific job, doesn't get a penny. Of course not, doesn't expect one.
He's great.
It's about social participation. It's about doing the right thing. It's about doing a satisfying thing. And the idea, I agree with what you're saying. The idea of everyone needing a job, everyone needing to be a part of a desperate system of competition against each other, it's bunk.
And yeah, we've just gotten used to it. And technology should be freeing us from it. It substantially has. If you think about food production, it's hugely automated compared to what it was 100 years ago. We should be free from that and not have wealth flow to a few patent holders or something like that. We fund a lot of the research that goes on, And we should be benefiting it by shorter work weeks, more time for poetry, science, art, mathematics. It's so crazy, but the mind, in especially in the United States, we just go to, we need jobs, we need more jobs. You're worrying about the laid off bus drivers with the new technology. I'm worried about that too. But we need to implement some policy by which they work less. They work one day a week or something like that. And maybe this basic income idea is a route to that. We get it in, we start expanding it, we work less, we enjoy life more. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Number to call, 503-231-8187 on KBOO Portland. And Chris is on the air.
Hello. Thank you for your wonderful program, Teresa. And especially as automation and robots begin to take over more of people's jobs, we're going to have to answer the question of a basic income. And it also gives people a lot more self-respect. But I wanted to go back on the topic of atomic power, nuclear weapons, as Obama's in Japan and heading over to Hiroshima to, look grieved and sad for the horrible things we've done to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, at the same time that we're investing $1 trillion into downsizing nuclear weapons to make them more usable and upgrading our whole nuclear arsenal.
Upgrading the arsenal, yes.
Yeah, so it seems amazing Obama can go over there and talk how bad he is and bring over the survivors from the Holocaust and not even mention Fukushima or, our upgrading of nuclear weapons as he's trying to talk about a nuclear-free world.
I'm glad you brought that up. It is a strange thing, isn't it? I mean,
in
45, it was a different world. I'm pretty sure that despite the occasional war movie, people don't realize that Russia lost 16 million people fighting the Germans. They don't realize just how bitter, racist, and hideous that war was. It was total war. And yet, I do think that the atomic bombings were unnecessary and brutal. They came in the context of non-atomic bombings, firebombings, that were intended to get to wipe out civilians and did very effectively do so. As a matter of fact, more people were wiped out by firestorms, the intentional kindling of a fire tornado in a city.
Yeah, if you've seen Fog of War, Errol Morris's film with McNamara, the war criminal, it talks a lot about the early bombing with LeMay and how LeMay wanted to go in Cuba and bomb them during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it seems now we got the same kind of crazy, advocating NATO encircling Russia and then this shift in offensives in the Asian continent area as well.
The madness of that war still affects us today, and it did bring about the nuclear era. And
you'll find it amazing. I was watching Slipping on the News Hour on PBS last night. They're talking about the long-term effects of radiation in reference to the Holocaust survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and never mentioned the ongoing nuclear problems we've had of the almost a half dozen nuclear accidents all over the world, on top of other issues with nuclear power as well. So it's amazing what you watch on news, and you got to appreciate that folks like Cabo and all the other independent media out there giving us the real truth and the real reality.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you take care. Keep up the great work.
Number call, 503-231-8187. Yes, I am concerned about those nuclear fuel pools in the United States, and part of the problem is that Fukushima, like so many things that affect elite power, is basically a big lie in the corporate press. I remember up to a couple of years ago, they were even talking about rebuilding. When will we rebuild? When will we be able to rebuild the reactors? It's just a ridiculous question. They're piles of slag with incredibly dangerous tons, many, many tons, hundreds of tons of reactor uranium. And plutonium, I'm sorry to say, because there's an even creepier aspect to this. Digging through the earth, burning its way down into the water table, and things are getting worse, actually, at Fukushima. Not only that, things were worse. You were lied to such an extent that is scarcely believable. For example, Chris Busby took air filters from cars in Tokyo and found that Tokyo had been very heavily dosed with radiation, which means that it's still dosed with radiation. If it weren't for lies, there would be no nuclear power. It just wouldn't exist. And it's a very convenient thing to lie about because its damage is slow and often slow and completely invisible. And it's hard to quantify a metallic taste on your tongue. Number to call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Randy's on the air.
Yeah, I haven't listened to the entire program, but a few things I wanted to mention. One, the earliest mention of the idea of a basic income was Thomas Paine, who qualifies as a founding father in his book Agrarian Justice.
Uh-huh.
Also, one point that gets missed is actually when you look at the writings of a lot of the right-wing intellectuals like Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek, they actually endorsed the idea of a basic income. It just kind of got omitted when their ideas were being put in practice in neoliberalism.
Well, I think that kind of shows that things are sliding further from capitalism into a sort of feudalism, like we're supposed to expect a grimmer future.
I think that's accurate, okay? Now, I am, here's the thing. I think that basically in terms of how we actually get it, number one, I think that that lowering the age of the military for their basic income would be something I think we could actually get political support on soon. The other thing that I think can be done sooner rather than later is expanding EITC benefits, particularly for dependent children. I mean, those are both things that actually have at least some support within the GOP, and I think will be hard for the GOP to avoid being split on.
Hey, isn't it funny, though? I mean, funny in a grim sort of way, when something as basic as food for children comes up and there are politicians like Ted Cruz who will just snap and snarl against it because they just, they can just develop hatred for these children who haven't pulled themselves up by their non-existent bootstraps.
Well, let me put it this way. There's a whole other issue around the negative personalities we get in our political system. I mean, Ted Cruz, was in fact, he presented himself at one point in law school as a libertarian. He changed and presented himself as a fundamentalist when he needed to get elected. And there's a whole other issue there that's not relevant. Now, I think another point on this one is as a trans issue, I believe that a basic income would be one of the best things for minorities like trans people that we've ever seen because it would give them greater ability to gather in friendly communities than they have now.
Oh, no, that's very true, and thank you for bringing that up. That is one of the ways in which trans people are very, very heavily discriminated against, but to say it that way, it doesn't really get it across. You can't get a job, and desperate.
No, and the funny thing is it'll actually do that for a lot of the disgruntled right-wing minorities also.
Yes.
That's the thing that they are missing.
Yes,
okay.
And I quite agree. That was the thing I was bringing up at the start. It's like to even discuss it is to immediately invoke this sullen resentment, the idea that white conservatives particularly have.
Technologies, I have actually worked with these technologies early on. I worked on, if you do a credit card transaction, it goes through a credit card fraud detection system that I helped with the first database integration of. And the thing is, a lot of people do not understand these technologies. I think the main push right now needs to be for A, greater safety, and B, I would like to see citizens' assemblies actually looking at these technologies. Citizen assemblies are groups of citizens chosen by lottery from the voter rolls, simply so there is some cross-section of the population that is meeting with people that understand these technologies so that it's not people going by what they read in the corporate media or going by what their friends say. They're actually getting direct access to some of the experts in the field.
Interesting. Thank you for that.
Yes. I mean, and I say this to somebody. I mean, I'm literally, what I did was one of the very first, what I did with a company called HNC in San Diego, which was bought out by Fair Isaacs. And when you do credit card transactions, about 70% of the time it goes through that system now.
Well, and thank you very much for your call. There's the music, and so I'll have to wrap up.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.
All right. I've enjoyed all of your company. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. You've been listening to Press Watch. Coming up Air Cascadia, 10 o'clock to 10:15, Flashpoints, 10:15 to 11. We're going out to you via 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to the world, and in that manner to all the ships at sea.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland. A busy Thursday morning. Flashpoints is up in 15 minutes. Today, former CIA officer Ray McGovern discusses Hillary Clinton's lies about security breaches and her private email server. Also, our weekly election protection bulletin with Greg Palast. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host Bethany Grabo speaks with Jesse Andrews, author of the new novel The Haters. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, Jen Chavez speaks with local experimental filmmaker Vanessa Rennick. Also on the show, Portland Horror Film Festival organizer Gwen Callahan, Daylight's End producer Sherry Dieterling, and director Will Kaufman, and Josh Leake. That's all coming up right after Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
I'm Margaret Cho, your host for Crossing East.
Well, in Vietnam, if you live with a GI, then they think you're part of two.
I am Chinese, Greek, Swedish, English, Scottish, German, Pennsylvania, Dutch.
I was born in Changsha. I don't know exactly what day they estimated the day.
On Crossing East.
Tune in this Memorial Day, May 30th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. to hear the entire Crossing East series on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, May 26, 2016, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, real radio for real people at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. First, weather. Today, patchy drizzle, slight chance of showers, and then chance of showers again much later. Seems like we might as well just have said chance of showers all day long. And high around 64. West-northwest winds, which could actually, for the most part, 5 to 11, they could gust up to